I asked Mimi about his behavior on their three dates, which included hot chocolate at Barnes & Noble, a few hours of painting pottery at a local ceramics center, and an afternoon of rock climbing at an indoor facility. Mimi recounted that Travis was a total gentleman, explaining that the only physical contact the two had was an awkward hug at the end of each date. I also wanted to demonstrate Arius's pattern of confronting women she viewed as rivals. I thought back to Matthew McCartney's story of how Arius had driven hours to challenge a woman who she viewed as a threat to her relationship with McCartney, and how similar it sounded to the way she had approached Mimi at Travis's memorial service. "Where was this service held?" I asked Mimi. "This was at the church building where he went to church every Sunday in Mesa. It's off Guadalupe and the 202 area."
"And were there a lot of people there, yes or no?"
"Yes, there were a lot of people."
"And of all the people that were there, was there somebody by the name of Jody Arius?"
"Yes."
"And is the person that you knew as Jody Arius, is she in court today?"
"Yes. She is seated over there at the end of the table, and I can't see her clearly, but she's wearing black and has dark hair."
Mimi pointed to Arius, who was seated at the far end of the defense table. I asked the judge to have the record reflect that Mimi had identified the defendant as Jody Arius. "So you see the defendant there, and do you go up to her, or does she go up to you?"
"She came up to me, and she introduced herself to me."
"What did she say?"
"She said, 'Are you Mimi Hall?' And I said yes, and she introduced herself as Jody Arius."
"And did she say anything else?"
"I asked her how she was doing, and she said she was upset. That was about it, though."
"Did at any time she say, 'I'm the person who killed him,' anything like that?"
"No."
"Did she ever tell you why she was there at the memorial service?"
"No."
"I don't have anything else, thank you."
As I returned to my seat, Nurmi stood and walked to the podium in the center of the courtroom to begin his cross-examination. Based on his questions, it appeared his objective was to show that Mimi's standing in the LDS Church, which included having been born into the faith and attending Brigham Young University, an institution supported by the church, commanded a certain level of respect and dictated the way that Travis viewed and treated her.
"Did he, Travis, tell you that he was having sexual relations with Jody Arius?" he asked Mimi.
"No,"
she replied, appearing to grow uncomfortable. "I'm not going to ask exactly what he said, but it was during a camping trip, if I recall correctly, that he told you he had a stalker?"
"Yeah. He didn't say a name at all, but he was having breakfast with a couple of friends around, and he told me at that point that he had a stalker, and that she had actually followed us on a date, and that she knew who I was. And I told him that was really scary and that he should get a restraining order."
This line of questioning caught my attention, and I wondered how far Nurmi would go into this area, which was highly inflammatory and could hurt his client. During my initial examination, I did not ask Mimi about whether she knew Arius to be a stalker or what she might have heard in that regard, because I didn't want to create any issues leading to a mistrial or being raised on appeal. Had I broached the subject first, the argument almost certainly would be that the prosecution had been unfair because these were unproven acts of domestic violence that were unrelated to the murder. But now that Nurmi was discussing Arius's stalking behavior with the witness, defense counsel was opening the door to the topic, allowing me to walk in and explore the details on my redirect examination.
"And you say that he didn't tell you. He didn't say that this was Jody, right?"
Nurmi continued.
"No, he didn't say who it was," Mimi responded.
She looked frail and vulnerable, and I felt sorry that she had to be up there on the witness stand and be asked about her friend's relationship with another woman. Nurmi showed her a page from a transcript to refresh her recollection of what she had said in an earlier interview where both he and I had been present.
"You said you gave him the advice that he seek a restraining order against this stalker, right?"
he asked. "Yeah."
"Okay. And you expressed to him that you were scared of this stalker, right?"
scared of any stalker. It's not something you want to deal with.
And to your knowledge, did he ever seek out a restraining order?
Not that I knew of, no. He told me not to be afraid.
And your testimony is that he never said to you Jody Arias was his stalker. That's your testimony?
That's from what I can remember. I don't remember him ever saying at the time. I remember hearing the name Jody. It could have been then, but I don't actually recall.
Mimi replied, adding,
The name Jody was mentioned the night that we found him at his house.
Okay, thank you, Miss Hall, Nurmi said as he concluded his cross-examination. My first question to Mimi on redirect examination continued the line of questioning that defense counsel had started when he asked her whether Travis had identified Arias as his stalker. You indicated that part of what he, Travis, told you was that this stalker was a female, right?
Yes.
And what had this female done that he was warning you about? Before Mimi could respond, Nurmi broke in with an objection. Beyond the scope, he told Judge Stevens. Nurmi's objection was overruled because he had questioned Mimi about Travis's stalker.
He had dated someone earlier that year, Mimi replied, referring to Travis's ex-girlfriend, Lisa Andrews. She slashed her, Andrews's, tires. She had sent threatening emails to both Travis and his girlfriend at the time. She had followed us on one of the first dates that we went on, and she sounded dangerous. She had broken into his email account, his bank accounts. She would break into his house through the doggy door and sleep on his couch at night without him knowing that she was there.
Having this portrait of Arias out there so early in the case enabled me to cast doubt on her portrayal as a victim. This testimony showed Arias to be a woman who not only was obsessed with Travis, but would act on that obsession. The following day, I called Detective Flores to the stand. The first area I intended to cover with him was his initial telephone conversation with Arias on June 10, 2008, the one he had with her after leaving the crime scene to return her call.
The jury would be hearing Arias's voice for the first time, and I wanted them to hear how engaging she could be, playing the part of the grieving ex-girlfriend.
To ensure the jury understood that Arias had brought the gun with her to Mesa, a significant step in her premeditation of the murder, I played the portion of the telephone conversation with Flores during which Arias had admitted to the detective that Travis did not have a gun in his home and did not have any other weapons. Since Wilmot had admitted in her opening statement that Arias had killed Travis, this meant that Arias must have brought a gun and a knife with her when she paid him the early morning visit on June 4, 2008.
Jurors sat impassively as I queued up the recording and Detective Flores's voice came over the sound system.
Do you know if he had any weapons in the house?
To which jurors heard Arias reply, his two fists.
That's it? No handguns or rifles?
No, he wasn't one to keep any of that. No, only his two fists. No, he was more like into wrestling and UFC, and he had a, you know, he said he just bought a punching bag and he's like, I love beating the crap out of the punching bag, you know? For the most part, Nurmi's cross-examination of Flores centered on Arias's comment about Travis's two fists as being his only weapon, and Travis beating the crap out of the punching bag as a way to illustrate why Arias was scared of him. But the fact remained that Arias had admitted to Flores that there was no gun in Travis's house, which could only mean one thing, that she had brought the gun with her with the intention of killing him. Nurmi's strategy of soiling Travis's character was evident in his final set of questions to Detective Flores when he asked about an agreement Arias had with Travis to clean his house.
Do you remember whether or not she had to do it in a French maid outfit? Nurmi asked, referring to the photograph of the French maid outfit that Arias discussed with Detective Flores during their July 15, 2008 interview in Wairika. Pausing as if to search his memory, the detective responded, That doesn't sound familiar to me.
Later in the questioning, immediately before ending his cross-examination, Nurmi asked about an instant messenger conversation between Travis and Arias. Although the conversation he was referencing had occurred via instant messenger, Nurmi referred to it as an email communication when he asked,
"Okay, do you remember seeing the emails in which Mr. Alexander referred to Miss Arias as a three-hole wonder?"
"Yes," Flores replied matter-of-factly.
"As a slut?"
"Yes."
"As a whore?"
"Yes."
"Thank you, detective."
It was clear that Nurmi's objective was to pick up where Wilmot's opening remarks had left off in painting Travis as a bad person. But introducing Travis's derogatory statements to Arias so early in the proceedings seemed a poor strategic decision, because as the trial progressed, Nurmi would do it so often that it became something he appeared to like repeating for its own sake, which lessened its shock value as well as its impact. When court reconvened that afternoon to continue with my redirect examination of Detective Flores, I was eager to give the jurors some insight into what had motivated Travis's offensive missives to Arias by providing the context in which they were written. While I knew that there was nothing I could do to eliminate those words from playing a part in the trial, I hoped that offering a sense of what was driving Travis's emotions would soften their harshness. I showed Flores a copy of the transcript of the instant messages the two had exchanged, and I asked him, "Why was the comment made as indicated in that document?" After an objection by Nurmi, I directed Flores's attention to the bottom of page 8 of the instant messenger conversation I had marked as an exhibit and handed it to him for his review. Flores spent a few seconds reading the passage before responding.
"He, Travis, references being used by Arias," he replied.
"What is he saying?" I asked, directing Flores to read aloud from the conversation.
"I think that I was little more than a dildo with a heartbeat to you," he recited from the instant message.
"And that is what he is saying to her?"
"Yes."
"And the previous pages, pages 1 and 2 and 3, do they talk about whether or not to tell the truth?"
"Yes."
Before I could make my point, Nurmi interjected with another objection, which the judge overruled. "And in terms of the reference to the three-hole wonder, what is the context of that comment?" I asked Flores.
"Travis is complaining about her lying to him."
And with that, I ended this first portion of Flores's testimony. Over the next several days, I called a number of witnesses to introduce the evidence that had been collected at the crime scene to show it had been Arias who had killed Travis. Among them was the expert who discussed the blood spatter patterns that helped explain Travis's movements during the attack, the fingerprint technician who identified the palm print on the west wall as belonging to Arias, and a DNA expert who analyzed the hair and blood on the palm print and matched them to Arias. I began my direct examination of Mesa Police Detective Michael Melendez by asking about the incriminating photographs he had retrieved from Travis's Sanyo camera.
During my direct examination, I asked Melendez to explain the 5 steps that Arias had taken to erase pictures from the camera, as well as the process he had used to retrieve those photos from the unallocated space on the camera's memory card. No small feat in light of the fact that Arias had put the camera through the wash cycle with bleach. Another point I made through Melendez's testimony was that Arias had not deleted all the photos on the camera's memory card, only those that were taken on June 4, 2008, which implicated her in the murder. It was unavoidable that the explicit nature of some of the photographs caused a stir in the courtroom, especially the ones of the afternoon sex session, which included close-ups of Arias's breasts and vaginal area, along with photos of Travis and Arias posing nude on Travis's bed with a tube of KY jelly in the foreground. By introducing all the photos, including those of a sexual nature, the first of which was time-stamped at 1:44:52 p.m., I wanted to establish that Travis and Arias had spent a substantial amount of time together that day.
and during that whole time, Arius had the gun and knife stashed somewhere nearby, ready to access them when the moment was right. I followed up that first set of photographs with the introduction of the pictures of Travis in the shower, with the first one bearing a timestamp of 5:22:24. Travis appeared very much at ease and altogether defenseless, without so much as a layer of clothing to protect him, as he poses nude in the shower for what the defendant had described to Detective Flores during their interview on July 16, 2008, as a classy photo shoot. The last photograph in that series, which was taken approximately 8 minutes later at 5:30:30, does not show Travis's face, only his torso and buttocks as he sits on the shower floor. Just 44 seconds later, the next photograph was snapped, which was the first of a set of three inadvertent pictures that capture parts of Arius's attack at three separate moments. In displaying this final set of photos, I wanted to show that less than a minute had elapsed between the time Arius admitted holding the camera to when the initial inadvertent photograph was snapped. As I showed him the first of the three inadvertent photographs, I asked Detective Melendez, "What do you see there?" "It's the ceiling area and the upper wall portion of the bathroom." "And the time?" I asked, making sure to establish that it had been 44 seconds since the last posed picture of Travis in the shower was taken. 5:31:14. He replied, confirming the time gap. I went from the photo of the bathroom ceiling to discussing the second inadvertent photograph, which showed a stocking foot in front of Travis's head, blood spilling from his neck onto his right shoulder as he lay lengthwise along the hallway with his feet toward the bathroom. I asked, "When you recovered this photograph, were you able to know or tell whether or not the camera, when it snapped the photograph, was it right side up or was it upside down?" "It was upside down." "And how do you know that?" "Because when I looked at the original image, it was upside down." This meant Arius had carried the camera throughout the attack until she apparently dropped it as she went to drag his body back down the hallway. "And this area down here?" I asked, pointing to Travis's right shoulder and the blood streaming to the tile floor. "Can you tell what this is?" "It's a stain. It looks like blood," he answered, knowing it was blood, but not committing to it because he hadn't tested it. When asked about the third and last inadvertent photograph, Detective Melendez explained that this showed Arius continuing to drag the body toward the sink area. All of these photographs, starting with the ones taken in the early afternoon to those in the early evening, were so incriminating that it was clear why Arius was so concerned with wanting to look at them during her interviews with Detective Flores in Yreka, and why she came up with the excuse that she had killed Travis in self-defense. Having these graphic photographs now in front of the jury, I was interested to see how defense counsel would deal with them, since they contradicted Arius's assertion that she had been the victim. She obviously wasn't being forced to pose for the afternoon nude photographs, and she showed her physical strength as she dragged Travis's limp, 189-pound body down the hallway. In her cross-examination of Detective Melendez, Jennifer Wilmot focused on questions related to the time gap between the last photograph of Travis in the shower and the first inadvertent photograph of the bathroom ceiling, apparently hoping to signal to the jury that while the pictures placed Arius in the bathroom of the master bedroom, they didn't capture the attack in its entirety, allowing Arius to argue what may have happened during that undocumented period of time. It would have been fruitless for Wilmot to challenge any of the photographs, so she resorted to pointing out what she labeled as a 45-second gap between the pictures, because that was the only unaccounted time period that would allow Arius to make her self-defense claim. Because the case was being televised, I was the subject of media scrutiny almost from the inception of the trial, particularly with regard to my courtroom presentation, which was being described as too animated and at times combative. The criticism was brought to my attention so that I might conform my style to what some in the media thought was a better way to approach the prosecution of the case. I was a little taken aback by the criticism, as this had always been my approach, and juries seemed to have appreciated the passion I had displayed during my previous presentations. I was not putting on a show because the media was in the courtroom, but was trying the case as I would any other. I had to follow the style of prosecution that had worked well for me many times before, so I ignored the criticism, always reminding myself that it was the jury's opinion that mattered. My conduct in the courtroom would come under further scrutiny during my redirect examination of Detective Melendez. As I was holding Travis's camera in my hand, I suddenly dropped it on the floor, to the surprise of everyone in the courtroom, and asked the detective, "Did that take 45 seconds, sir?" My dramatic gesture drew a strong objection from Wilmot. "Judge, I am going to object. That's evidence that was just dropped on the floor," Wilmot shouted, an objection that the judge immediately overruled. I hadn't planned to drop the camera. I did it in response to Wilmot's implication during her cross-examination that it had been Travis who had initiated a confrontation during the 44-second gap. It was a way of illustrating that although Detective Melendez did not know what had happened during those 44 seconds, whatever had happened occurred unexpectedly, just like the camera hitting the floor. And it showed that just as everyone in the courtroom had been caught by surprise, so had Travis, when Arias attacked him with the knife. Chapter 17. The case I had presented thus far was based in large part on the investigation by the Mesa Police Department, and left little room for the jurors to conclude that anyone other than Jody Arias was solely responsible for killing Travis Alexander. But there was still the issue of premeditation for the jury to consider and decide, and with that in mind, I turned to the efforts of other agencies that had assisted in the inquiry, including the Yreka Police Department, the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office, and the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner. Dr. Kevin Horn, a graduate of the University of Maryland, had been with the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner since 2001. My objective in calling Dr. Horn was to describe Travis's many injuries, the order in which they occurred, and how these injuries led to Travis's death. Dr. Horn would also be able to address the defense's claim that he had given erroneous information to Detective Flores that contradicted his findings with regard to the sequence of the injuries Travis sustained. With Dr. Horn on the stand, I moved to introduce 41 autopsy photos to supplement his testimony. There were photographs showing the injuries to Travis's head and body, as well as photographs of several X-rays that indicated where the bullet had come to rest in his left cheek. I began my presentation by putting the first photo of Travis's face onto the ELMO, E-L-M-O, courtroom system, which projected it onto the three monitors strategically placed around the courtroom. The ELMO was connected to a large movie-style screen that dropped down from the ceiling for jurors to view, as well as to two TV monitors, one behind the witness stand and the other facing the gallery. This first picture was a close-up shot of Travis's face, which appeared purple and splotchy in areas and showed the gunshot wound above his right eyebrow. I saw Travis's siblings in the first and second rows out of the corner of my eye and realized the presentation was affecting them, as both Samantha and Tanisha had started to silently cry. I know that for family members and friends of the victims in the courtroom, listening to the testimony is never easy. Still, I had a responsibility to present the best evidence to support my case, and I focused on that. Having established Travis's identity by this first photo, I moved to the photographs of the X-rays, which would identify any foreign objects in either his head, neck, or chest, the areas that had sustained the mortal injuries. The most significant of the three was a frontal view of the head, which showed that the bullet had gone through the brain and come to rest just inside Travis's left cheek.
According to Dr. Horn's testimony, the path that the bullet traveled was a downward trajectory, indicating that the muzzle of the gun was above the head when the shot was fired. Because she was at least 2 inches shorter than Travis, this trajectory implied that she stood over him as she fired the gun. Before we talked about the multiple injuries he observed during his visual examination, I asked him to explain how he determines whether a wound has been inflicted before or after death.
If there's hemorrhaging associated with an injury, then it is before death, he said. What is it that causes a person to hemorrhage? If you have a heartbeat, you are going to have blood flow to the area that's injured, and so you have blood flow from an injury. So if the skin is cut or torn, there will be a great deal of blood that will come from an injury in a living person, Dr. Horn clarified. A deceased person will lose some blood, but not a great deal. If an individual is dead and somebody applies some force, hits them, are they going to bruise necessarily or not? I asked. There may be something that would look like a bruise, but it will not be as large and the color will be different in a deceased person because there is no blood flow to the area.
Are you familiar with the term defensive wound? I asked, eager to have Dr. Horn speak to the deep incisions on Travis's left hand as illustrated by the next autopsy photo I put up for the jurors.
Yes, Dr. Horn replied. They're based largely on location on the body. If you have injuries to the back of the forearms or to the palms or backs of the hands, you can have gunshot wounds in those locations, or in the case of an assault with a knife or an edged weapon, you can have cuts or incised injuries to the back of the palms or backs of the forearm. And it's consistent with someone trying to either grab the knife or fend off wounds, or fend off injury.
To illustrate the concept of defensive wounds, I pointed Dr. Horn to the photo of Travis's left hand and asked him to explain the injuries in the image. Dr. Horn determined that all the injuries on the left hand were consistent with defensive wounds. Dr. Horn couldn't identify the kind of blade that was used to inflict the injuries, but could only say that it was a sharp-edged object. Speaking about all of the wounds on Travis's left hand, I asked, "Are they consistent with defensive wounds?"
"Yes." "And does that mean that Mr. Alexander was alive at the time these injuries were inflicted?" "I believe he was."
I next displayed a photo of Travis's naked body lying face up on the autopsy table, showing the areas from the top of the head to just below the genitals. A number of incision-type injuries and stab wounds were visible in this photo, including the ear-to-ear gash to Travis's throat. There was a perceptible reaction in the courtroom, and I could feel the tension as I began asking Dr. Horn to provide details of each one. He began by describing a 1-inch superficial injury on the right shoulder before moving on to the 3 stab wounds to the chest, starting with the one right near the biceps.
"That one goes all the way to the breastbone," he said, "but does not go all the way to the chest cavity. It would not be fatal."
The same could not be said for a second, deeper wound in the middle of the chest area that he described as a stab wound.
"That one actually penetrates a major vessel coming into the heart," he said as he explained how the vein drains into the heart. "So what happens when the knife goes in and causes this amount of damage?" I asked. "Well, depending on the position of the body, you may have significant internal bleeding. Or if the person is leaning forward, they may bleed outside the body because there's a tract leading from that vessel outside. But this was a major vessel. It's not going to bleed as fast as an artery, but it will bleed a considerable amount."
With regard to this considerable amount of bleeding that's going on, is this a wound that could kill this person? I continued.
"Yes."
"And do you have an estimate, or is there any science out there that tells you, well, this type of wound, given what I know about it, would take X amount of time for death to ensue?"
"No," Dr. Horn replied, It depends on so many factors. It depends on the person's health. It depends on the care that they received. It depends on their blood volume to begin with and the position of their body. This was an important detail to spell out because I wanted to establish that Travis had been experiencing mental anguish and excruciating physical pain after the initiation of the attack, proving he was the one who needed to defend himself, not Arius, as she alleged. Dr. Horn went on to describe that while eventually unconsciousness would result from the wound, it wouldn't happen right away. When you say eventually, do you have an estimate, maybe minutes, seconds, between the time of infliction and the time that he lapsed into unconsciousness? I asked. If that were the only wound, and it's not, probably a few minutes, because we're dealing with a vein and not an artery, so it's a low-pressure system, so blood loss is slower. With this wound to the heart, he should have been able to get his hands up and attempt to defend himself. If he was in a seated position when this wound was inflicted, would he have the ability, even though this was inflicted, to get up and walk somewhere or move quickly somewhere, as a matter of fact? Yes. Dr. Horn's answer, when considered along with the evidence collected at the scene, confirmed the sequence of the mortal wounds. While the stab wound to the chest would eventually be fatal, Travis would still have been conscious at first, giving him the opportunity to grab at the knife, as shown by the defensive wounds on his left hand. He also had time to make his way to the vanity, where he stood bleeding over the sink while Arius stabbed him repeatedly in the back, resulting in the type of blood spatter patterns identified by Lisa Perry on the mirror and sink. The large ovoid stain on the carpet at the threshold between the bathroom hallway and the master bedroom confirms that after standing at the sink, Travis got as far as the doorway before collapsing to the floor, where Arius slit his throat from ear to ear, causing his neck to bleed profusely. The left palm print swathed in Travis's and Arius's blood on the west wall, along with the inadvertent photographs, detail Arius's next move, which was to drag the body back down the hallway into the bathroom. She stopped dragging his body in front of the sink long enough to shoot him in the head while he was on the ground, with the downward trajectory of the bullet leaving no doubt that she stood over him when she fired the single shot. The casing from the semi-automatic gun was ejected, landing in a pool of Travis's blood that he had previously shed. She completed her ghastly pilgrimage by dragging the body the rest of the way and shoving it into the shower, where it stayed until it was found 5 days later. Dr. Horn also discussed other non-lethal wounds, which included a 5 3/4-inch puncture by the belly button that he believed had been inflicted from left to right and slightly downward, as well as contusions on the right leg that were consistent with the body having been dragged. Travis had also sustained a grouping of 9 injuries to the back, which were visible in the next photograph I displayed. More likely than not, they occurred close in time, and they, a lot of them, most of them, have the same orientation, Dr. Horn explained, referring to a cluster of 9 wounds on the upper back. In general, except for one exception I can see at the lower edge, they are oriented exactly the same direction. They are in a diagonal extending from the right shoulder toward the lower left side of the back. From Dr. Horn's testimony, it was clear that Arius had the knife in her right hand when she inflicted those wounds, as he stood facing the sink with his back turned, which created the blood spatter patterns in and around the sink area. To illustrate this theory, I did a demonstration for the jury, motioning with my right hand as if I were holding a knife and repeatedly stabbing in a downward motion. And these injuries that we're talking about coming this way like that, could they be consistent with an individual having his back, as I have to you, turned to the attacker, and the attacker is stabbing him like that? I asked Dr. Horn. Yes. We have 9 injuries, and they are all clustered together.
"They're in the center," he explained, indicating their location on Travis's upper back.
"They're all about the same depth. They are about an inch, and they are going into the back part of the ribs and the spine, the spinal bone, and stopped there. And none of them entered the chest cavity."
Of the two fatal stab wounds, the most significant one was the gaping slit to Travis's throat, which Dr. Horn described as so deep it passes through the airway so the windpipe is cut through. "Let me stop you," I interjected. "When it passes through the airway, does this individual lose the ability to scream at that point or not?"
"It's below the larynx, below the voice box, so yes," Dr. Horn replied.
This was disturbing because it suggested that Arius cut his throat to stop him from calling out for help as he struggled for his life.
"And if this person, well, this person is alive at this point, according to you, right? He's still alive?"
"Yes."
In a literal sense, this left Travis gasping because the air from his lungs was now being pushed through the gash in his throat rather than through his nose and mouth, causing agonal noises as the air was expelled.
"Where would the blood start coming out as a result of this wound here?" I asked, still pointing to the throat.
"Well, right next to the windpipe are the major vessels of the neck. You've got the carotid artery, you've got the jugular vein. My examination did show that the jugular vein and the carotid artery on the right side were both cut," Dr. Horn said.
It was during this part of Dr. Horn's testimony that I noticed Arius, dressed in a blue top and black cardigan, hiding her face behind thick strands of her long brown hair, as if trying to shield herself from the graphic images being displayed for the jurors. At certain moments, she appeared to be crying behind the thick-framed glasses that she had begun wearing during the trial, raising her left hand up to her eyes as if to wipe away tears. As the presentation continued, she was either turning her face away from the images or staring blankly as they appeared on the monitor, which made me wonder if she was just feeling sorry for herself because she got caught. I didn't let myself get distracted by her performance, and instead continued my direct examination by asking Dr. Horn to describe the depth of the wound to Travis's neck.
"It goes all the way back to the spine, so it's 3 inches, 4 inches," Dr. Horn continued. "It doesn't go through the spinal cord, so it doesn't penetrate that bone. So it's actually the soft tissues in the front of the neck and then stops at the bone."
Once this was inflicted on Mr. Alexander, is this something that's number one, rapidly fatal? And number two, what about lapsing into unconsciousness? If you could talk to us about those two things.
"He has two major vessels in this throat that have been cut. He's going to lose a great deal of blood very quickly. He's going to lose consciousness within seconds, likely, and then die a few minutes later."
"In terms of unconsciousness, how much time are we talking about?"
"A few seconds, probably." We had talked about the two of the three mortal injuries, the stab wound to the chest and the slitting of the throat.
Now I introduced a photo that depicted the gunshot wound visible just above Travis's right eyebrow.
"And what's the trajectory of this gunshot wound?" I asked Dr. Horn. "It passes down through the skull, passes through the face and downward and to the left, and terminates in the left cheek."
Dr. Horn told jurors he didn't know the distance from the muzzle of the gun to the temple where the bullet entered the head, but he was able to determine the trajectory.
"The problem in this case is that the brain was decomposed," he explained, "and the brain is a very soft structure to begin with, so it falls apart very rapidly after death. So I was not able to see a track through the brain. But just because the bullet passes through the front of the skull where the brain normally would be, I have to conclude that the brain was perforated."
"And if the brain is perforated, what would happen to this individual once he was shot?"
"He would be incapacitated," Dr. Horn replied.
"Went down?"
"Yes."
"Immediately?"
"Rapidly, yes."
The path of the gunshot and whether or not it had perforated Travis's brain would be a sticking point for the defense, as their client was contending that, after dropping Travis's camera during their picture-taking session in the shower, Travis had become enraged and chased her to the bedroom and around the closet. It was here that she claimed she found a gun and shot him, a scenario that would be impossible based on Dr. Horn's testimony that the gunshot would have rendered Travis incapacitated and unable to move, much less chase after her. Arias's story would also be impossible because, as she told Detective Flores during her June 10, 2008 phone call, Travis did not have a gun in the house. So, if that's the scenario in this case, we have the defensive wounds to the hands. What does that tell you about the sequencing of these three injuries? I believe the wounds to the hands must have occurred before the fatal injuries either of the head or of the throat, Dr. Horn explained. So what you're saying is that at some point during the stabbing, but before the slashing of the throat and before the gunshot to the head, this individual grabbed the knife. Attempted to. It was a powerful image, Travis in the shower trying to grab at the knife as it slashed toward him. Tell me about the sequencing of events as applied to the two injuries, the one to the head and the slitting of the throat, and when this individual may have grabbed the knife or the knife was applied to his hands. With the throat wound and the head wound, I don't think this person could have had a purposeful activity, meaning I don't think they could have raised their arms and attempted to defend themselves. With a chest wound, that's possible because he would not have been immediately unconscious. Which wound would have been first, in your opinion? Well, the stab wound could have occurred and then the defensive injuries could have happened after the wound to the chest occurred. And then in terms of the sequence of the injuries involving the throat injury we talked about, what is your opinion? Well, the throat injuries and or the head wound are going to be immediately incapacitating, and he's not going to attempt to defend himself after that. In terms of the shot to the head, do you have an opinion as to whether or not he was alive at the time that that shot was struck? I can't say. Do you have an opinion as to the wound to the neck? Whether or not he was alive at the time that that was rendered, if you will. I believe he was. There's a great deal of hemorrhage associated with that. And was he alive with regard to the one to the chest that we have been talking about? Yes, I believe he was. Beyond indicating that the strike to the chest was the first mortal blow, Dr. Horn's testimony was important in highlighting for the jury another aspect of Arias's plan to kill Travis. The mortal blows were inflicted by two separate weapons, a gun and a knife. Arias's preparedness in bringing a backup weapon should the other fail went a long way in proving that she planned the attack. The three mortal wounds, along with the more than 20 non-fatal injuries, speak to overkill and demonstrate Arias's single-minded intent to end Travis's life, even if it took repeated knife strikes and switching to a gun to deliver a parting shot. With the end of my direct examination of Dr. Horn, Jennifer Wilmot rose to begin her cross-examination. As I suspected, Wilmot spent a good deal of time working to infuse doubt into Horn's testimony by questioning his opinion that the bullet had perforated the brain. If she could have him admit that he was uncertain whether it had gone through the front part of the brain, she could argue in favor of Arias's claim that the bullet was the first injury she inflicted, not the last. Horn did not waver, maintaining that he could determine both the path of the bullet and when it was fired in relation to the other injuries. You didn't find any evidence of trauma or, like, a bullet track through the brain? She asked. Nothing so clearly defined, no hemorrhage, no foreign bodies, no metal fragments, right? Dr. Horn repeated his findings. For the most part, if you have a bullet pass through the brain, you're not going to be standing, you're not going to be functional, you're going to fall. Well, just so we're clear, you don't actually have any medical evidence of it passing through the brain, right? Wilmot prodded, attempting to use earlier testimony that he had not been able to determine the bullet's track through the brain because the brain was already decomposed when he conducted his examination. Her apparent goal was to cast doubt on the entirety of Dr. Horn's findings by claiming that he was going beyond what the medical examination had revealed by maintaining that the bullet had passed through the brain. It had to have passed through the brain, Dr. Horn replied emphatically. You don't have medical evidence of that, do you?
I do, Dr. Horn insisted. The skull is perforated where the brain is, so it had to have passed through the brain.
But you have no idea. You have no medical evidence of how far or what part of the brain it exactly would have hit, right?
It would have passed through the right frontal lobe, Dr. Horn replied. I don't have any evidence of hemorrhage now because of the decomposition, but it had to have passed through the brain because of the part of the skull that was injured. The brain, in a young person especially, is flush against that structure. The brain occupies the entire skull, so to have a hole in the skull here, he indicated the area of Travis's right temple on the autopsy photo, and then exit in here, he pointed to Travis's left cheek, it has to pass through the brain.
Having failed to shake Dr. Horn's testimony about the bullet track through the brain, Wilmot moved on to other topics, including testimony that had been given by Detective Flores at an earlier hearing that appeared to differ from Dr. Horn's. Isn't it true that at some point you told Detective Flores that you believed the first wound was a shot to the head?
I don't remember ever saying that.
Do you think that you never told Detective Flores that? Wilmot asked.
I don't think that's consistent with the evidence that I have, and I don't remember ever saying anything like that, Dr. Horn repeated.
So what your testimony is, I just want to be clear, is that you never told Detective Flores that the gunshot wound was the first wound.
I don't believe I ever said that, no.
And do you remember telling Detective Flores that you knew this because the gunshot wound wouldn't have completely incapacitated somebody?
I don't recall saying that either, Dr. Horn stated.
She continued to press this point, attempting to sow doubt in Dr. Horn's words, or at the very least make it appear that he was contradicting himself. Horn was confident in his opinion, and eventually, having failed to shake his testimony, Wilmot gave up and ended her cross-examination. Dr. Horn's testimony that he recovered a bullet from Travis's left cheek that forensics firearms examiner Elizabeth Northcutt found to be consistent with a .25 caliber round made it important for me to bring in Officer Kevin Friedman of the Wairika Police Department. Officer Friedman testified that he responded to a cold burglary on May 28, 2008, at around 3:40 p.m. at the Pine Street home that Arias shared with her grandparents, Caroline and Carlton Allen. He conducted the investigation, which included looking at the point of entry on the south side of the house, taking fingerprints, and determining what had been taken. Officer Friedman portrayed the burglary as unusual, explaining that four items had been taken: a DVD player, a stereo, $30 in bills, and a black-handled .25 caliber gun, just one item from each of the home's four rooms, while small items worth money and a large amount of change had been left behind. Officer Friedman also testified that he thought it was strange that only one of the firearms, the black-handled .25 caliber handgun, was stolen from the dresser that had been converted into a gun cabinet, where other handguns of various calibers were also kept. The .25 caliber handgun taken from Arias's grandparents' house was the same caliber as the casing found in Travis's bathroom. The jury already knew by Arias's own admission to Detective Flores that Travis did not have any guns in his house, leaving no doubt that she had staged the burglary in order to obtain her grandfather's gun to help carry out her plan to end Travis's life. I continued my case by calling Detective Nathan Mendez, formerly the lead detective of the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office's Major Crime Unit, and had him testify to Arias's efforts to hide her identity for her trip to Mesa.
Detective Mendez and his team had assisted detectives from the Mesa Police Department in locating and arresting Arias at her grandparents' home in Yreka. Detective Mendez, who was now a special agent for the United States Department of the Interior, had also helped execute the search warrant on Arias's grandparents' Pine Street home that same day, so I intended to introduce the receipts from the Airwalk shoebox through his testimony. I showed the detective a photograph of the small bedroom in which the shoebox had been found during the execution of the search warrant. "Did police have occasion to search this box here?" I asked, pointing to the white box with the red logo that sat atop the twin bed with the patriotic red, white, and blue quilt. "Yes, sir." Holding up the bundle of receipts that had been found inside the box, I asked if he recognized them. "Yes, sir. These are items taken during the service of the search warrant," he replied. "I move for admission of Exhibits 237.001 through 237.022, I said, knowing there would be no objection because defense counsel would think those receipts actually helped corroborate Arias's story that the detour to Mesa was the result of an impromptu decision after speaking with Travis while she was already on the road.
"No objection, Your Honor," Nurmi said.
One by one, in a serial fashion, almost bordering on the mechanical, I showed each receipt to the jury through the testimony of Detective Mendez, only pausing long enough to identify the various merchants and the dates of each purchase, and sometimes mentioning Jody Arias as the person who had made the transaction. The first receipt I showed Detective Mendez was the one from Budget Rent-A-Car System for the Ford Focus that Arias had rented at the Reading Airport. I turned my attention to establishing Arias's aim of not being recognized on the day she rented the vehicle. "Back in June 2008, were there car rental companies in Yreka?" I asked.
"Yes, sir, there are at least two others," the detective said. "There was Hertz and Enterprise."
"But there was Budget there, right?"
"No, sir."
"Are you familiar with Redding, California?" I asked.
"Yes, sir."
"In fact, you live near Redding now, or not?"
"Yes, I do."
"And with regard to Redding as it relates to Yreka, how far apart are they?"
"Just under 90 miles.
"And approximately, what is the driving time between Yreka and Redding, California?" I asked.
"In the summertime, about an hour and a half," Detective Mendez said, explaining that it could be a longer drive in the winter because there's a lot of snow in Siskiyou County.
I next asked Detective Mendez about his visit to the budget counter at the Reading Airport to show the photographic lineup of five pictures, including a mugshot of Jody Arias labeled as number 5, to the rental car agent Rafael Colombo. "What did he say when you showed him that in terms of the identification?"
"He said that the person that came in and rented the vehicle was number 5, except that she had blonde hair when she came in and got the car," Mendez told the jury.
Moving the questioning back to the items that had been found in the Airwalk shoebox, I showed Detective Mendez the remainder of the receipts for his identification, going through the different stops that Arias had made, including the gas stations, bank, and Walmart. I didn't want to call undue attention to the transactions at the Arco gas station in Pasadena, where Arias made 3 separate gas purchases, so I purposely did not focus on the amount of gasoline purchased, but instead concentrated on the times those purchases were made. I wanted the jury to see that there were 3 sheets of paper associated with the 3 different sales, so that there would be no confusion later when I questioned Arias about the 3 separate purchases, if she took the stand as I predicted. I also wanted to make sure they were not thinking there had only been 2 sales, so I asked a question in a way that emphasized that the 2 cash receipts were not repeats of each other, careful not to go any further, and ended my direct examination. From the line of questioning that Nurmi pursued during his short cross-examination, it was apparent the defense was not concerned with any of the purchases Arias made on her trip. Instead, Nurmi focused his questions on the 3 deposits Arias made at the Washington Mutual Bank in Pasadena.
From his questions, it appeared that the source of the money was somehow significant to the defense, although for me it was just a time marker that Arias had stopped at the bank in Pasadena at 10:15 a.m. on her way to Mesa to kill Travis. To support Detective Mendez's testimony, I called Rafael Colombo, who told jurors about renting the car to a blonde-haired Jody Arias. West Jordan Police Detective Michael Gallietti then testified about the traffic stop in which he observed that Arias's back license plate was upside down and the front one was missing. Ryan Burns was in court to testify to Arias's late arrival in Utah, the excuses she provided for her tardiness, the traffic stop by police, and the sexual contact the two engaged in during her brief time in West Jordan. On cross-examination, defense counsel continued along the same path they had taken with Detective Flores of attacking Travis's character rather than focusing on the evidence that undermined Arias's self-defense claim. Nurmi asked Burns if he had heard from others that Travis was a big flirt and whether Arias had told him that Travis had cheated on her. The line of questioning was out of place because it didn't address the conflicting stories Arias had told him about her delayed arrival, her phone charger, and the upside-down back license plate. Using this witness to try to establish what they wanted the jury to perceive as Travis's inappropriate interactions with women was misplaced, as Burns had no personal knowledge and could only speak to what Arias and a few others had told him. On the ninth and final day of my case in chief, I called my last witnesses, among them Detective Flores again. As part of my direct examination of Flores, I played the telephone message Arias had left for the detective on June 21st, in which she provided her mobile phone number, setting the stage for the introduction of the phone records through the testimony of the custodian of records for the mobile phone carrier Sprint. What I hadn't expected was the line of questioning Nurmi would pursue during his cross-examination of Flores that inadvertently emphasized Jody Arias's momentous error in leaving the camera behind in the washing machine on the day she killed Travis.
Detective, you were present when the photos of Ms. Arias and Mr. Alexander were shown in court?
Nurmi asked Flores.
Yes. And that was a few weeks after the investigation that those photographs were actually recovered, right?
Yes.
Before they obtained those, had you had any other evidence that Ms. Arias was at Mr. Alexander's home on June 4th?
Nurmi continued, to which Flores answered, no. After 9 days of testimony and 20 different witnesses, it was now clear to the jury that Arias believed everything had gone according to her plan. And it had, except for that one slip-up that Flores was able to highlight in his final testimony. As planned, I concluded with Arias's PPL friend, Leslie Udy, who testified to several conversations she'd had with Arias, including the two telephone calls Arias made to her after supposedly learning of Travis's death. Udy described Arias's apparent sadness and claims of disbelief. Udy's testimony was meant to remind the jurors that Arias's feigned disbelief at the news of Travis's death was just another part of her cover-up. Most emblematic of this deception was the hour-long conversation Udy had with Arias on the evening of June 5, 2008, as the two sat in Arias's rental car in the parking lot of Chili's, days before Travis's body would be discovered stuffed in the shower. We talked about Travis, Udy recalled. She said they weren't together anymore, which I already knew, but that they would always be friends, and that they had joked and laughed about the fact that at some point further on, they would see each other at the prepaid legal events, and their children would play together and be friends. She indicated that although they were broken up and weren't together anymore, they would always be best friends. Udy also recounted for the jury the two telephone calls she received from Arias, the first on the morning of June 10, 2008, telling her Travis was dead, and the second around 2 o'clock the following morning. And what was she saying, I asked, with regard to the second call? She was saying that this was about the time of day that she would normally talk to Travis, they were both night people and that they talk about that time, and that she had lost her best friend and that she didn't know what to do. It was then that I asked Udi the final question of my case in chief. In any of those three conversations, did she ever tell you that she killed Travis? No, she replied. Udi's testimony helped unveil the deviousness that was Jody Arias, someone who would even manipulate her own friend in her time of grief. But her full unmasking would have to wait until cross-examination, where her dark soul would finally be exposed. Chapter 18. On Thursday, January 17th, I rested my case, and the court indicated that trial would resume with the beginning of the defense's presentation of evidence on Tuesday, January 29th, giving us a 12-day recess. But while those 12 days offered a break from the trial, there would be no shortage of drama. The court set an evidentiary hearing for Monday, January 28th, to hear evidence of supposed prosecutorial misconduct, one of the many occasions when such an allegation would be made by defense counsel as the trial progressed. Defense counsel refused to tell me what acts they believed constituted the misconduct and which witnesses would testify in support of their latest accusation, giving them an obvious tactical advantage at the upcoming hearing. Fortunately, their key witness, someone named Gus Searcy, talked to others about the hearing and his upcoming testimony, claiming it would change the course of the trial. Searcy, an executive director at Prepaid Legal Services, now called Legal Shield, held himself out as the paradigm of success at the network marketing company. He had met Arias at a PPL business briefing in Arizona when she approached him to help her attain the kind of success that he professed to have achieved, because, as he was quick to say, he had become an executive director in 90 days, a rate of progress that normally takes more than a year for others to achieve. Searcy's lack of discretion gave me the necessary forewarning about the allegation he would make at the hearing, where he intended to accuse Travis's friend and mentor, Chris Hughes, of trying to sway his testimony. This allowed me to contact Hughes, who denied the allegations and agreed to travel